Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present author and columnist Alexander Coburn, who discusses the current travails of crony capitalism and opportunities which may now be open for progressive social movements to influence public policy. Beth Van Skock, trial attorney with the Center for Justice and Accountability, who describes her court victory against two former Salvadoran generals, made to pay $55 million in damages to victims of army torture during El Salvador's bloody civil war. And Steve Cobble, associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, who explains why he believes this fall's Brazilian presidential election may be the year's most important political contest. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In recent weeks, the dispute over the territory of Kashmir has cooled down. India and Pakistan have pulled back their military forces, and under a deal fostered by American diplomats, Pakistan's military has limited the infiltration of Islamic militants into the Indian-controlled zones of Kashmir. While the confrontation of last May has faded, where India and Pakistan mobilized 1 million troops, most media accounts blamed Islamic militants who in recent years had the open aid of Pakistan security agents. According to the World Press Review magazine, India has treated Kashmir as a colony and refused to take seriously those pushing for an independent Kashmir. During the last 12 years, the conflict has turned extremely violent, with 34,000 civilians being killed. In a report issued in early June, Amnesty International claimed 100 people in Kashmir died every month from actions of the Indian security forces. Each year, Amnesty states there are hundreds of cases of torture, death, executions, and disappearances of those held by India's military. Even moderate Kashmiris with past ties to India's Congress Party blame politicians in New Delhi for the current impasse. As Kashmiri dissident Mehbooba Mufti insisted, "They treat us like a colony. People cannot elect their own representatives. Every election has been rigged since the first vote in 1951. In Eastern Europe, the body count of coal miners is mounting. Over a decade ago in the old Soviet Union, one miner died for every million tons of coal extracted. Today in the Ukraine, four miners die to dig out the same amount of coal. Worse, coal miners cannot depend on a steady paycheck from doing Europe's most dangerous job. And according to the news magazine In These Times, miners can work for months without a paycheck, as coal customers, such as state-owned power plants, refuse to pay their bills. There are also widespread stories of corruption as local managers manipulate the price of coal to line their own pockets. The former Soviet state is the fifth largest recipient of U.S. international aid, and the World Bank has lent over $300 million to the country's mining sector. Yet living conditions just get worse. Guy Standing of the International Labor Organization says the economic crisis has spread from mining to the industrial and agricultural sectors. For now, the World Bank's only solution to the crisis is to close more coal mines and lay off coal miners. Closings have already begun at 90 mines. Yet the Ukrainian government is going slow out of fear of unleashing massive unemployment and labor unrest. The Progressive magazine reports that Minnesota Green Party candidate Ed Eagleman McGaugh, a Native American and author of books on spirituality, could tip the balance in the U.S. Senate. Two-term incumbent Paul Wellstone, a progressive Democrat, is neck and neck with Republican Norm Coleman, the former mayor of St. Paul. The outcome of the race could determine if the Democrats retain control in the U.S. Senate. At the moment, the race is so tight that Wellstone allies have tried to get the Greens to skip the race. Instead, the Greens, upset over the overt pressure, nominated McGaugh, a war veteran and a supporter of the current war on terrorism. In an interview with The Progressive, McGaugh's positions were at odds with the Green Party national platform that includes opposition to the war in Afghanistan and corporate-led globalization. For now, most national progressive groups are working hard to re-elect Wellstone, who is in trouble partly because he broke a promise to only serve two terms in the Senate. This summer, NARAL and the League of Conservation Voters are raising money and organizing get-out-the-vote drives for November. Still, Minnesota's Green Party could spoil Wellstone's plans in the same state that elected Jesse Ventura as governor just 4 years ago. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer Cousineau.
After a week of record losses, the stock market bounced partway back, giving investors and worried retirees a frightening roller coaster ride. But news of corporate corruption, which in part triggered the volatility on Wall Street, continues to trickle out. Quest Communications International is another in a growing list of companies admitting that they had overstated their earnings. The telecommunications firm revealed on July 28th that they had improperly accounted for more than $1.1 billion in recent years. After the collapse of Enron, Adelphia, WorldCom, Global Crossing, and others, this latest revelation will undoubtedly further shake the confidence of consumers and investors. Despite congressional passage of new regulations governing business behavior, many citizens have also lost confidence in the major political parties to rein in corporate corruption, given that both Republicans and Democrats are addicted to large corporate contributions. In a recent column titled, "The Hog Wallow, Popgun Populism Isn't Enough," The Nation magazine's Alexander Coburn notes how unrestrained corporate greed over the last decade drove many companies into debt, while generous stock options fatten the wallets of millionaire CEOs. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Counterpunch co-editor Alexander Coburn, who discusses the current travails of crony capitalism and opportunities which may now be open for progressive social movements to influence public policy.
Capitalism, by definition, is a system that runs amok. You can go back through corporate history, capitalist history for the last 100 years, and you'll find the same pattern. You get a boom, which then transitions into a bubble. And in the bubble period, every kind of shady device is used to enhance the money of the insiders, to fool the people on Main Street. And then the whole thing collapses, and there's a period of indignation, and the politicians mount the pulpit, and people like George Bush say that there must be a better way. And that usually coincides with the period of decline of the bubble. Then sometimes there's a spasm of virtuous cleanup, and sometimes there's an intervention, and then the whole show gets on the road again. We're in the period of, I think, probably rather not particularly protracted public indignation.
You recently wrote a column titled "The Hog Wallow, Popgun Populism Isn't Enough." And your point is that there are deep systemic problems, and people are just... Democrats and Republicans are just throwing Band-Aids on these bigger issues.
Not even Band-Aids. I mean, look at the Democrats. They wouldn't even, led by Lieberman, they wouldn't even change the accounting rules that allowed half this chicanery to go on in the first place. I mean, if ever there was a case when you could say that Nader has been vindicated, this is surely it. I mean, even the most stalwart defenders of the Democrats are embarrassed when you've got Daschle and the Democrats, really, when it comes to the nitty-gritty, which is a lot of the current scandal, which is, you know, staggering misrepresentation. If you followed the hearings last week, you had the disclosure that Citigroup and Morgan had faked the books with Enron to conceal, I think it was upward of $2 billion in loans. Now, they're going to be sued by the big retirement pensions, and that's going to be pretty serious for them. It'll be a nasty fight. Once you get an outfit like CalPERS, you know, the California Retirement Fund, which is very, very large, or LACMA, which is the big Los Angeles County Municipal Employee Fund, worth about $30 billion. You get them suing the banks for misleading them about their investments. Then you've got the stage set for a pretty big struggle.
Certainly, both President Bush and Vice President Cheney have little scandals of their own that they're dealing with at the moment. Harkin Oil Company, the failed oil company Bush had a hand in and made some money off of just before it lost a lot of money. And then Halliburton, large corporation that does a lot of business with the U.S. government. We have similar kind of questions about Dick Cheney and his role as CEO. And tell us a little bit where you think those scandals may be headed.
Well, I think that's what's so deadly for the Bush administration is that, you know, the way that both Bush and Cheney made their money is absolutely dead, bullseye central to the and representative of and symbolic of the whole burst, creation of the bubble, the deception of the outside investor by insider beneficiaries and so forth. Bush's own business is about to go belly up. It's taken over by Harkin. Harkin itself does very badly, but then an unknown institutional investor, which some people think may have been Harvard-connected, suddenly buys a huge amount of Harkin shares. Their shares then go up, enabling George Bush to cash in. In an insider transaction, he doesn't report to the SEC. That's what the whole all these scandals are basically about. And then, of course, he goes on possibly to profit from insider knowledge of the impending invasion of Kuwait by Iraq and makes a bundle that way. Enormous scandal. I mean, I'm no friend of Clinton, but this is obviously far larger in terms of financial payout and far more potentially serious than a failed real estate transaction in Arkansas. As for Cheney, in the takeover of Dresser Industries by Halliburton, there's some very questionable stuff as regarding what was divulged to the public, and Cheney goes home at the end of the day when he leaves with, $36 million, I think. And, of course, still steadfastly refuses to release the records of what input energy companies had in the early meetings in the White House. So here's Cheney, you know, he's meant to be not seen because of the security problems of the war on terror, but he's probably not seen because he's dodging a subpoena.
Well, just a final question. Margaret Thatcher quoted widely over the last couple of decades, there is no alternative, she said, and certainly many people in the right, the center, and the ranks of liberal Democrats signed on to that. There is no alternative. Are we going to be coming up, progressive movements in general, going to be coming up with some progressive alternatives to the status quo?
Absolutely. I think this is a great time, whether it's the idea of a decent social wage, which is the Fair Wage campaign, you know, which has been going along now for, what, nearly a decade. You cannot get by privatizing everything and paying everybody sub-minimum wage levels. I think, personally, pension funds is going to be the great debate of the next 50 years, because that's really about what you might call socializing accumulation. You're either going to say we live in a dog-eat-dog world where, you know, you won't care about the old folk, you won't care about social responsibility, you'll just pillage and destroy, or you say that our wealth must be socialized, the decision-making must be socialized, the social net, whether it's in insurance or health insurance and the rest of it. The present conditions, I think, are propitious, really, to come ahead and say, for 20 years, we've been not talking right about how the society should be run. And the ideas are there, the alternatives are there, and Thatcher, one of the world's stupidest women, of course, typically said, there is no alternative. Of course there are alternatives. Exciting time we live in.
That was Nation magazine columnist and author Alexander Coburn. His online publication, Counterpunch, can be found on the Internet at www.counterpunch.org or call 1-800-840-3683. During the 1980s, an estimated 75,000 people were killed in El Salvador's bloody civil war, the vast majority civilians. The U.S. government supported the ruling elite to the tune of $1 million a day, mostly in military aid. Thousands of people were executed or tortured by the army and allied death squads. Three Salvadorans living in the U.S., one now a U.S. citizen, sued two Salvadoran generals who were in power during the war years, charging them with torture under U.S. law. The same laws used 2 years ago to try these two generals for the rape and murder of four American churchwomen in El Salvador in 1980. The generals, Jose Guillermo Garcia and Carlos Eugenio Vides Casanova, were acquitted in that case. But in this more recent case, filed by the Center for Justice and Accountability in San Francisco, the plaintiffs won. In a July 23rd verdict, the jury ordered the Salvadoran generals to pay the victims almost $55 million in damages. The defendants have 30 days to appeal the decision. Beth Van Schaak, one of the trial attorneys, said the generals received no support from the current government of El Salvador, and they may not be able to afford an appeal. They probably can't afford to pay the damages either, but Van Schaak says that wasn't the goal of bringing the case. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Van Schaak about why the Salvadoran survivors sued in U.S. courts and what they hope to gain from this verdict.
From the beginning, this has never been about the money judgment for the plaintiff. And they all said, well, there's no amount of money that could compensate me anyway for what's happened to me. So for them, it's very much about the fact that they got a legal judgment that a jury of their now peers, their contemporary peers in the United States, found these two generals legally responsible under the doctrine of command responsibility for the harm that befell them at the hands of subordinates of these two generals. And that means a world to them. I mean, what it means essentially is that these two generals were allowing their subordinates to detain and torture civilians. So that's incredible for a country that refused to even acknowledge that torture was happening in detention centers, to have a jury say that, in fact, torture was happening wide scale and that these two individuals are responsible for it is an enormous victory for these victims.
Just explain a little bit about the different statutes that allowed people in the United States, whether they're now citizens or not, but with the time of these incidents, they were not U.S. citizens, to sue in a U.S. court over incidents that happened outside the U.S.
That's right. There are two main statutes. The first is called the Alien Tort Claims Act. That was one of the first statutes ever passed by our Congress when we became a sovereign nation. And the idea was to allow federal courts, as opposed to state courts, to adjudicate international law violations. There were some disputes between foreign diplomats that suddenly this country realized there was no court in which those diplomats could air their grievances. And so this statute was passed in order to allow those cases to go forward. Then under Bush Sr., a second statute was passed called the Torture Victim Protection Act, which essentially reaffirms the use of the Alien Tort Claims Act for modern international human rights violations, such as the ones that were part of our case.
Are there going to be more individuals who are sued, against whom complaints are going to be made? Do you know of any already, or do you expect that that will happen?
I don't know of any additional cases. The three plaintiffs in this case, I think, although it was not a class action per se, I think the three plaintiffs in this case very much felt like they were suing on behalf of more than just themselves. And so a lot of what they were seeking was a statement about not just what happened to them, but what happened to Salvadoran society and what happened to normal civilians going about their lives and getting caught up in these waves of repression that were being orchestrated by the military there. So there may be additional suits, but I think a lot of victims will probably feel like their story was told through these three. And if, in fact, there won't be a money judgment that will be obtainable, that justice has already been done against at least these two defendants. Now, there are obviously, you're right, a number of high-level Salvadoran officials who are likely no longer in El Salvador and subject to the jurisdiction of United States courts. But that's something to be, you know, further researched.
I just wondered how this tactic of bringing suit in the U.S. under these two statutes that you mentioned, how that relates, if at all, to the Truth Commission's work in El Salvador after the war ended. Did anyone have to be accountable in that process in El Salvador?
There's obviously a lot of different models for truth commissions. The Latin American model, which was first being developed, often just involved victims coming forward to tell their story. So it was a sort of a pure truth commission in that it's victim-focused. Sometimes reparations are available, but not always, and individual perpetrators are not necessarily named. The Salvadoran Truth Commission went a couple of steps further and allowed victims to tell their story again, wrote a sort of historical record of the repression in El Salvador, but also named names of individuals who were responsible either directly for violations or for, let's say, cover-ups or for implementing a policy that enabled violations to happen. So individuals were named in the Salvadoran Truth Commission, but there were no additional implications to that. In other words, there were no criminal prosecutions or civil suits following the Truth Commission, because an amnesty was passed days after the Truth Commission issued its report. So that amnesty covers both criminal matters and civil matters. So really going forward, there was no possibility of doing any legal suits. The legal team relied very heavily on that Truth Commission report, because one of the things we had to show in order to hold the two defendants liable was that there was a pattern and practice of human rights abuses around the country of which they were aware. And once a commander is aware that subordinates are committing abuses, he can become liable for those abuses if he fails to take all necessary and reasonable measures to prevent those abuses and to punish perpetrators. So the Truth Commission's work was invaluable, but many Salvadorans feel like it did not go far enough, and that that's why a case like this is so important, because it assigns individual blame, and it basically identifies a particular person who was responsible and provides a remedy for a particular victim.
That was Beth Van Schaak, legal advisor to the Center for Justice and Accountability. Contact the center by calling area code 415-544-0444 or visit their website at www.cja.org. Brazilian voters are getting ready to elect a new president this fall, a decision that could have far-reaching consequences for international trade and economic policy. Workers' Party candidate Luiz Inácio da Silva is making his fourth run for the presidency and remains ahead in public opinion polls. But Lula, as he's known, has been favored to win before, only to be undermined by Brazilian and U.S. businesses fearful of his progressive pro-worker agenda. This year, however, things may just go his way with Brazil's economy in trouble, high-profile corporate corruption scandals, and business-friendly conservative parties divided. But as the first round of elections approach, the U.S. government and Wall Street are still capable of making credible threats to dissuade Brazilians from voting for Lula. While much attention in the U.S. is focused on this November's midterm congressional election, Steve Cobble of the Institute for Policy Studies argues that Brazil's presidential race is perhaps the most important political contest this year. He contends that the struggle against corporate-led globalization, championed by social justice movements here in the U.S., will benefit greatly from Lula gaining power in Brazil. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Steve Cobble about what he believes is at stake in Brazil's October 6th election.
The biggest party on the left in Brazil is the Workers' Party. And Lula is the former head of the Metal Workers Union and is their most prominent candidate, political leader. He ran the first time for president back in 1989, and he's been ahead in the polls before, but they have a runoff system in Brazil, and normally when they get to the second round, the opposition parties to him consolidate against him, and so far they've defeated him. But this year might well be different. He seems to have a real chance to become the president, and the first round election is in October, and then the runoff will be about a month later. One of the main differences this year from the past is the Workers' Party in Brazil has come to power in several of the largest cities and a couple of the states of Brazil. So they're seen as a governing party now that is competent and can govern. And unlike the ruling parties, they're not regarded as corrupt.
The most important election of 2002 is the title of the article that you wrote. And describe to our listeners why this election is so important, not only for Brazil, but the hemisphere and the world.
In my opinion, it's important that we have some counterbalance to what Ralph Nader would call the unfettered free traders that seem to reside disproportionately in the United States. Many of your listeners may know that the House gave fast-track authority to the president by a small three-vote margin, 215 to 212. Part of what this means is they are now going to try to negotiate a free trade area of the Americas, sort of a NAFTA for the whole hemisphere. Brazil is 180 million people. It actually has more people of African descent than any country outside of Nigeria. It's a growing economy. It's one of the top eight economies in the world. So it's the closest country that might be able to negotiate on at least partially equivalent terms with the United States. If Lula were in charge and he were negotiating with the United States about free trade, there would be much more likely to have some respect for the environment and the rainforest, for labor rights, for some of the things that we have talked about in the United States about including in these agreements, but they never seem to make it. But I think in terms of the rich-poor divide and the north-south problems that are really going to drive a lot of the hemispheric discussion over the next 10, 20 years, the Brazilian election could end up being extremely significant.
As we talk about the threats to Lula's candidacy from outside of Brazil, tell us a little bit about how Wall Street and the White House views Lula and the Workers' Party and the prospect of him taking power in Brazil.
Well, the White House hasn't too much tipped its hand on this yet, although I think it's safe to assume they would prefer the current parties to go ahead and win another round because they can negotiate with them much more easily. Wall Street has made its position very clear. They've essentially said to the Brazilians, if you elect this guy, we're probably going to call in your loans, which, of course, like most other countries in the hemisphere, Brazil does have loans, and they're quite big. The economy's in trouble. They have a debt. And if the loans were called, it would be a problem for the next president. So the Wall Street has this ability to roll them over or to talk to the IMF and the other money funds, and they can give them better treatment or worse treatment. They've sort of made it clear that Lula would not get favored treatment. You know, in the recent one-day coup in Venezuela, the United States indicated that even though there was an extreme breach of democracy, we acted quite content with that breach in public. Some administration officials applauded it. And then we made it clear that even now, if there is a coup, that they're still not going to pull their loans. So Wall Street has essentially said to the Brazilians, if you want your economic troubles to keep up, you know, vote in Lula. This has the potential to backfire, by the way. It's not like Wall Street has a great reputation right now. There's the fear of the economy going into a bigger tailspin balanced against the idea of, you know, big shot outsiders from Wall Street telling the Brazilians what they can do in their election. The average Brazilian voter doesn't like that much.
Steve Cabo, what is the special role of progressives here in the United States when it comes to this Brazilian election and the shenanigans that Wall Street might be up to prevent Lula and the Workers' Party from taking power?
Sunshine is the greatest disinfectant, the old saying on freedom of information stuff. Well, it's true in this case, too, because whatever they decide to do in Brazil, they'd mostly rather it be behind the scenes. And so I think progressives' jobs is to keep doing research, pay attention, get whatever media attention we can to whatever's going on that they'd prefer behind the scenes and make it in front of the scenes. And then they'll probably stop doing it, or at least if they keep doing it, they'll risk a backlash.
That was Steve Cabo, Associate Fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and former political director at the National Rainbow Coalition. Contact IPS at area code 202-234-9382. Or visit their website at www.ips-dc.org. A recent article by Steve Cabo on the Brazilian election can be read online at www.thenation.com. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756, or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program is produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Sasha Summer Cousineau, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.